No, I said. Adidas, he said. Screw Adidas, I said. You should work for me. Help me sell these new Japanese running shoes. I handed him a Tiger Flat, told him about my trip to Japan, my meeting with Onitsuka. He bent the shoe, examined the sole. Pretty cool, he said. He was intrigued, but no. I'm getting married, he said. Not sure I can take on a new venture right now. I didn't take his rejection to heart. It was the first time I'd heard the word no in months. Life was good. Life was grand. I even had a sort of girlfriend, though I didn't have much time for her. I was happy, maybe as happy as I'd ever been. And happiness can be dangerous. It dulls the senses. Thus, I wasn't prepared for that dreadful letter. It was from a high school wrestling coach in some benighted town back east, some little burg on Long Island called Valley Stream or Massapequa or Manhasset. I had to read it twice before I understood. The coach claimed that he was just back from Japan, where he'd met with top executives at Onitsuka, who'd anointed him their exclusive American distributor. Since he'd heard that I was selling Tigers, I was therefore poaching, and he ordered me to stop. Heart pounding, I phoned my cousin, Doug Hauser. He'd graduated from Stanford Law School and was now working at a respected firm in town. I asked him to look into this Mr. Manhasset, find out what he could, then back the guy off with a letter. Saying what, exactly, Cousin Hauser asked. That any attempt to interfere with Blue Ribbon will be met with swift legal reprisal, I said. My business was 2 months old, and I was embroiled in a legal battle? Serve me right for daring to call myself happy. Next, I sat down and dashed off a frantic letter to Onitsuka. Dear sirs, I was very distressed to receive a letter this morning from a man in Manhasset, New York, who claims... I waited for a response. And waited. I wrote again. Nanimo. Nothing. Cousin Hauser found out that Mr. Manhasset was something of a celebrity. Before becoming a high school wrestling coach, he'd been a model. One of the original Marlboro men. Beautiful, I thought. Just what I need. A pissing match with some mythic American cowboy. I went into a deep funk. I became such a grouch, such poor company, the girlfriend fell away. Each night I'd sit with my family at dinner, moving my mother's pot roast and vegetables around my plate. Then I'd sit with my father in the nook, staring glumly at the TV. Buck, my father said, you look like someone hit you in the back of the head with a 2x4. Snap out of it. But I couldn't. I kept going over my meeting at Onitsuka. The executives had shown me such K. They bowed to me and vice versa. I'd been straightforward with them, honest, for the most part. Sure, I hadn't technically owned a business called Blue Ribbon, but that was splitting hairs. I owned one now, and it had single-handedly brought Tigers to the West Coast. And it could sell Tigers 10 times faster if Onitsuka gave me half a chance. Instead, the company was going to cut me out? Throw me over for the frickin' Marlboro man? Come where the flavor is. Toward summer's end, I still hadn't heard from Onitsuka, and I'd all but given up on the idea of selling shoes. Labor Day, however, I had a change of heart. I couldn't give up, not yet. And not giving up meant flying back to Japan. I needed to force a showdown with Onitsuka. I ran the idea by my father. He still didn't like me jackassing around with shoes, but what he really didn't like was someone mistreating his son. He furrowed his brow. You should probably go, he said. I talked it over with my mother. No probablys about it, she said. In fact, she'd drive me to the airport. 50 years later, I can see us in that car. I can recall every detail. It was a bright, clear day. No humidity, temperature in the low 80s. Both of us, quietly watching the sunlight play across the windshield, said nothing. The silence between us was like the silence on the many days she drove me to meets. I was too busy fighting my nerves to talk, and she, better than anyone, understood. She respected the lines we draw around ourselves in crisis. Then, as we neared the airport, she broke the silence. "Just be yourself," she said. I looked out the window. "Be myself. Really? Is that my best option? To study the self is to forget the self." I looked down. I certainly wasn't dressed like myself. I was wearing a new suit, a proper charcoal gray, and toting a small suitcase. In the side pocket was a new book, How to Do Business with the Japanese. Heaven only knows how or where I'd heard about it. And now I grimace to remember this last detail. I was also wearing a black bowler hat. I'd bought it expressly for this trip, thinking it made me look older. In fact, it made me look mad, stark, staring mad, as if I'd escaped from a Victorian insane asylum inside a painting by Magritte. I spent most of the flight memorizing how to do business with the Japanese. When my eyes grew tired, I shut the book and stared out the window. I tried to talk to myself, to coach myself up. I told myself that I needed to put aside hurt feelings, put aside all thoughts of injustice, which would only make me emotional and keep me from thinking clearly. Emotion would be fatal. I needed to remain cool. I thought back on my running career at Oregon. I'd competed with and against men far better, faster, more physically gifted. Many were future Olympians. And yet I trained myself to forget this unhappy fact. People reflexively assume that competition is always a good thing, that it always brings out the best in people. But that's only true of people who can forget the competition. The art of competing, I'd learned from track, was the art of forgetting. And I now reminded myself of that fact. You must forget your limits. You must forget your doubts, your pain, your past. You must forget that internal voice screaming, begging, not one more step. And when it's not possible to forget it, you must negotiate with it. I thought over all the races in which my body wanted one thing and my mind wanted another. Those laps in which I'd had to tell my body, yes, you raised some excellent points, but let's keep going anyway. And yet, despite all my negotiations with that voice, the skill had never come naturally, and now I feared that I was out of practice. As the plane swooped down toward Haneda Airport, I told myself that I'd need to summon the old skill quickly or lose. I could not bear the thought of losing. The 1964 Olympics were about to be held in Japan, so I had my pick of brand new, reasonably priced lodgings in Kobe. I got a room right downtown at the Newport, which featured a revolving restaurant on the top, just like the one atop the brand new Space Needle, a touch of home to settle my nerves. Before unpacking, I phoned Onitsuka and left a message. "I'm here, and I request a meeting." Then I sat on the edge of the bed and stared at the phone. At last it rang. A prim-sounding secretary informed me that my contact at Onitsuka, Mr. Miyazaki, no longer worked there. Bad sign. His replacement, Mr. Morimoto, did not wish me to come to the company's headquarters. Very bad sign. Instead, she said, Mr. Morimoto would meet me for tea in my hotel's revolving restaurant tomorrow morning. I went to bed early, slept fitfully. Dreams of car chases, prison, duels. The same dreams that had always plagued me the night before a big meet or date or exam. I rose at dawn, ate a breakfast of raw egg poured over hot rice and some grilled fish, and washed it down with a pot of green tea. Then, reciting memorized passages from How to Do Business with the Japanese, I shaved my pale jaws. I cut myself once or twice and had trouble stopping the bleeding. I must have been a sight. Finally, I put on my suit and shambled onto the elevator. As I pressed the button for the top floor, I noticed that my hand was white as bone. Morimoto arrived on time. He was about my age, but far more mature, more self-assured. He wore a rumpled sport coat and had a kind of rumpled face. We sat at a table by the window. Immediately, before the waiter came to take our order, I launched into my pitch, saying everything I'd vowed not to say. I told Morimoto how distressed I was by this Marlboro man encroaching on my turf. I said I'd been under the impression that I'd made a personal connection with the executives I'd met the previous year, and the impression was understood by a letter from Mr. Miyazaki saying the 13 Western states were exclusively mine. I was therefore at a loss to explain this treatment. I appealed to Morimoto's sense of fairness, to his sense of honor. He looked uncomfortable, so I took a breath, paused. I raised it from the personal to the general. I cited my robust sales. I dropped the name of my partner, the legendary coach whose reputation had cachet even on the other side of the Pacific. I emphasized all that I might do for Onitsuka in the future, if given a chance. Morimoto took a sip of tea. When it was clear that I'd talked myself out, he set down his cup and looked out the window. Slowly, we rotated above Kobe. I will get back to you. Another fitful night. I got up several times, went to the window, watched the ships bobbing on Kobe's dark purple bay. Beautiful place, I thought. Too bad all beauty is beyond me. The world is without beauty when you lose, and I was about to lose big time. I knew that in the morning, Morimoto would tell me he was sorry, nothing personal, it was just business. But they were going with the Marlboro man. At 9 a.m. sharp, the phone by the bed rang. Morimoto. Mr. Onitsuka himself wishes to see you, he said. I put on my suit and took a taxi to Onitsuka headquarters. In the conference room, the familiar conference room, Morimoto pointed me to a chair in the middle of the table. The middle, this time, not the head. No more K. He sat across from me and stared at me as the room slowly filled with executives. When everyone was there, Morimoto nodded to me. Hi, he said. I plunged in, essentially repeating what I'd said to him the previous morning. As I built to my crescendo, as I prepared to close, all heads swiveled toward the door, and I stopped mid-sentence. The temperature of the room dropped 10 degrees. The founder of the company, Mr. Onitsuka, had arrived. Dressed in a dark blue Italian suit, with a head of black hair as thick as shag carpet, he filled every man in the conference room with fear. He seemed oblivious, however. For all his power, for all his wealth, his movements were deferential. He came forward haltingly with a shuffling gait, giving no sign he was the boss of all bosses, the shogun of shoes. Slowly he made his way around the table, making brief eye contact with each executive. Eventually he came to me. We bowed to each other, shook hands. Now he took the seat at the head of the table, and Morimoto tried to summarize my reason for being there. Mr. Onitsuka raised a hand, cut him off. Without preamble, he launched into a long, passionate monologue. Some time ago, he said, he'd had a vision, a wondrous glimpse of the future. Everyone in the world wear athletic shoes all the time, he said. I know this day come. He paused, looking around the table at each person to see if they also knew. His gaze rested on me. He smiled. I smiled. He blinked twice. You remind me of myself when I am young, he said softly. He stared into my eyes. 1 second. 2. Now he turned his gaze to Morimoto. This about those 13 Western states, he said? Yes, Morimoto said. Onitsuka said. He narrowed his eyes, looked down. He seemed to be meditating. Again, he looked up at me. Yes, he said. All right. You have Western states. The Marlboro man, he said, could continue selling his wrestling shoes nationwide, but would limit his track shoe sales to the East Coast. Mr. Onitsuka would personally write to the Marlboro man and inform him of this decision. He rose. I rose. Everyone rose. We all bowed. He left the conference room. Everyone remaining in the conference room exhaled. So, it is decided, Morimoto said. For 1 year, he added. Then the subject would be revisited. I thanked Morimoto, assured him that Onitsuka wouldn't regret its faith in me. I went around the table shaking everyone's hand, bowing, and when I came back to Morimoto, I gave his hand an extra vigorous shake. I then followed a secretary into a side room, where I signed several contracts and placed an order for a whopping $3,500 worth of shoes. I ran all the way back to my hotel. Halfway there, I started skipping, then leaping through the air like a dancer. At some point, I stopped at a railing and looked out at the bay. None of its beauty was lost on me now. I watched the boats gliding before a brisk wind and decided that I would hire one. I would take a boat ride on the inland sea. An hour later, I was standing in the prow of a sampan, wind in my hair, riding into the sunset, feeling pretty good about myself. The next day, I boarded a train to Tokyo. It was time at last to ascend into the clouds. All the guidebooks said to climb Mount Fuji at night. A proper climb, they said, must culminate with a view of sunrise from the summit. So I arrived at the base of the mountain promptly at dusk. The day had been muggy, but the air was growing cooler, and right away I rethought my decision to wear Bermuda shorts, a t-shirt, and tigers. I saw a man coming down the mountain in a rubberized coat. I stopped him and offered him $3 for his coat. He looked at me, looked at the coat, nodded. I was negotiating successful deals all over Japan. As night fell, hundreds of natives and tourists appeared and began streaming up the mountain. All I noticed were carrying long wooden sticks with tinkling bells attached. I spotted an older British couple and asked them about these sticks. They ward off evil spirits, the woman said. There are evil spirits on this mountain, I asked. Presumably. I bought a stick. I then noticed people gathering at a roadside stand and buying straw shoes. The British woman explained that Fuji was an active volcano, and its ash and soot were guaranteed to ruin shoes. Climbers, therefore, wore disposable straw sandals. I bought sandals. Slightly poorer, but properly outfitted at last, I set off. There were many ways down Mount Fuji, according to my guidebook, but only one way up. Life lesson in that, I thought. Signs along the upward path, written in many languages, said there would be 9 stations before the summit, each offering food and a place to rest. Within 2 hours, however, I passed Station 3 several times. Did the Japanese count differently? Alarmed, I wondered if 13 Western states might actually mean 3. At Station 7, I stopped and bought a Japanese beer and a cup of noodles. While eating my dinner, I fell to talking with another couple. They were Americans younger than me, students, I assumed. He was preppy in a ridiculous sort of way. Golf slacks and tennis shirt and cloth belt. He was all the colors of an Easter egg. She was pure beatnik. Torn jeans, faded t-shirt, wild dark hair. Her wide-set eyes were brown-black, like little cups of espresso. Both were sweating from the climb. They mentioned that I wasn't. I shrugged and said that I'd run track at Oregon. Half-miler. The young man scowled. His girlfriend said, "Wow." We finished our beers and resumed climbing together. Her name was Sarah. She was from Maryland. Horse country, she said. Rich country, I thought. She'd grown up riding and jumping and showing and still spent much of her life in saddles and show rings. She talked about her favorite ponies and horses as if they were her closest friends. I asked about her family. "Daddy owns a candy bar company," she said. She mentioned the company and I laughed. I'd eaten many of her family's candy bars, sometimes before a race. The company was founded by her grandfather, she said, though she hastened to add that she had no interest in money. I caught her boyfriend scowling again. She was studying philosophy at Connecticut College for Women. Not a great school, she said apologetically. She'd wanted to go to Smith, where her sister was a senior, but she didn't get in. You sound as if you haven't gotten over the rejection, I said. Not even close, she said. Rejection is never easy, I said. You can say that again. Her voice was peculiar. She pronounced certain words oddly, and I couldn't decide if it was a Maryland accent or a speech impediment. Whichever, it was adorable. She asked me what brought me to Japan. I explained that I'd come to save my shoe company. Your company, she said. Clearly, she was thinking about the men in her family, founders of companies, captains of industry, entrepreneurs. Yes, I said, my company. And did you save it? She asked. I did, I said. All the boys back home are going to business school, she said. And then they all plan to become bankers. She rolled her eyes, adding, everyone does the same thing, so boring. Boredom scares me, I said. Ah, that's because you're a rebel. I stopped climbing, stabbed my walking stick into the ground. Me, a rebel? My face grew warm. As we neared the summit, the path grew narrow. I mentioned that it reminded me of a trail I'd hiked in the Himalayas. Sarah and the boyfriend stared. Himalayas? Now she was really impressed. And he was really put out. As the summit came slowly into view, the climb became tricky, treacherous, and she seized my hand. The Japanese have a saying, her boyfriend shouted over his shoulder to us, to everyone. A wise man climbs Fuji once, a fool climbs it twice. No one laughed, though I wanted to at his Easter egg clothing. On the very top, we came to a large wooden torii gate. We sat beside it and waited. The air was strange, not quite dark, not quite light. Then the sun crept above the horizon. I told Sarah and her boyfriend that the Japanese place torii gates at sacral borderlands, portals between this world and the world beyond. Wherever you pass from the profane to the sacred, I said, you'll find a torii gate. Sarah liked that. I told her that Zen masters believed mountains flow, but that we can't always perceive the flow with our limited senses, and indeed, in that moment, we did feel as if Fuji was flowing, as if we were riding a wave across the world. Unlike the climb up, the climb down took no effort and no time. At the bottom, I bowed and said goodbye to Sarah and the Easter egg. Yoroshiku ne. Nice meeting you. Where you headed? Sarah asked. I think I'm going to stay at the Hakone Inn tonight, I said. Well, she said, I'm coming with you. I took a step back. I looked at the boyfriend. He scowled. I realized at last that he wasn't her boyfriend. Happy Easter. We spent 2 days at the inn, laughing, talking, falling, beginning. If only this could never end, we said, but of course it had to. I had to go back to Tokyo to catch a flight home, and Sarah was determined to move on, see the rest of Japan. We made no plans to see each other again. She was a free spirit. She didn't believe in plans. Goodbye, she said. Hajime mashite, I said. Lovely meeting you. Hours before I boarded my plane, I stopped at the American Express office. I knew she'd have to stop there, too, at some point, to get money from her candy bar people. I left her a note. You've got to fly over Portland to get to the East Coast. Why not stop for a visit? My first night home over dinner, I told my family the good news. I'd met a girl. Then I told them the other good news. I'd saved my company. I turned and looked hard at my twin sisters. They spent half of every day crouched beside the telephone, waiting to pounce on it at the first ring. Her name is Sarah, I said, so if she calls, please be nice. Weeks later, I came home from running errands, and there she was, in my living room, sitting with my mother and sisters. "Surprise," she said. She'd gotten my note and decided to take me up on my offer. She'd phoned from the airport, and my sister Joanne had answered and shown what sisters are for. She promptly drove out to the airport and fetched Sarah. I laughed. We hugged awkwardly, my mother and sisters watching. "Let's go for a walk," I said. I got her a jacket from the servants' quarters, and we walked in a light rain to a wooded park nearby. She saw Mount Hood in the distance and agreed that it looked astonishingly like Fuji, which made us both reminisce. I asked where she was staying. "Silly boy," she said. The second time she'd invited herself into my space. For 2 weeks, she lived in my parents' guest room, just like one of the family, which I began to think she might one day be. I watched in disbelief as she charmed the uncharmable nights. My protective sisters, my shy mother, my autocratic father, they were no match for her, especially my father. When she shook his hand, she looked directly into the center of his eyes and melted something hard at his core. Maybe it was growing up among the candy bar people and other mogul friends. She had the kind of self-confidence you run across once or twice in a lifetime. I brought Sarah down to the worldwide headquarters of Blue Ribbon in the basement and showed her my wares. I gave her a pair of Limber-Ups. She wore them when we drove out to the coast. We went hiking up Humbug Mountain and crabbing along the scalloped coastline and huckleberry picking in the woods. Standing under an 80-foot spruce, we shared a huckleberry kiss. When it was time for her to fly back to Maryland, I was bereft. I wrote her every other day, my first ever love letters. "Dear Sarah, I think about sitting beside that Torii gate with you." She always wrote back right away. She always expressed her undying love. That Christmas, 1964, she returned. This time, I picked her up at the airport. On the way to my house, she told me that there had been a terrible row before she got on the plane. Her parents forbade her to come. They didn't approve of me. "My father screamed," she said. "What did he scream?" I asked. She imitated his voice. "You can't meet a guy on Mount Fuji who's going to amount to anything." I winced. I knew I had two strikes against me, but I didn't realize climbing Mount Fuji was one of them. What was so bad about climbing Mount Fuji? "How did you get away?" I asked. "My brother, he snuck me out of the house early this morning and drove me to the airport." I wondered if she really loved me, or just saw me as a chance to rebel. During the day, while I was busy working on Blue Ribbon stuff, Sarah would hang out with my mother. At night, she and I would go downtown for dinner and drinks. On the weekend, we skied Mount Hood. When it was time for her to return home, I was bereft again. "Dear Sarah, I love you. I miss you." She wrote back right away. She missed me, too. She loved me, too. Then, with the winter rains, there was a slight cooling in her letters. They were less effusive, or so I thought. Maybe it's just my imagination, I told myself. But I had to know. I phoned her. It wasn't my imagination. She said she'd given it a lot of thought, and she wasn't sure we were right for each other. She wasn't sure I was sophisticated enough for her. Sophisticated, that was the word she used. Before I could protest, before I could negotiate, she hung up. I took out a piece of paper and typed her a long letter begging her to reconsider. She wrote back right away. No sale. The new shipment of shoes arrived from Onitsuka. I could hardly bring myself to care. I spent weeks in a fog. I hid in the basement. I hid in the servants' quarters. I lay on my bed and stared vacantly at my blue ribbons. Though I didn't tell them, my family knew. They didn't ask for details. They didn't need them or want them. Except my sister Jean. While I was out one day, she went into the servants' quarters and into my desk and found Sarah's letters. Later, when I came home and went down to the basement, Jean came and found me. She sat on the floor beside me and said she'd read the letters, all of them, carefully, concluding with the final rejection. I looked away. "You're better off without her," Jean said. My eyes filled with tears. I nodded thanks. Not knowing what to say, I asked Jean if she'd like to do some part-time work for Blue Ribbon. I was pretty far behind, and I could sure use some help. Since you're so interested in mail, I said hoarsely, maybe you'd enjoy doing some secretarial work. $1.50 an hour? She chuckled. And thus my sister became the first ever employee of Blue Ribbon. 1965. I got a letter from that Jeff Johnson fellow at the start of the year. After our chance meeting at Occidental, I sent him a pair of tigers as a gift, and now he wrote to say that he'd tried them on and gone for a run. He liked them, he said. He liked them a whole lot. Others liked them, too. People kept stopping him and pointing at his feet and asking where they could buy some neat shoes like those. Johnson had gotten married since I last saw him, he said, and there was already a baby on the way, so he was looking for ways to earn extra cash, apart from his gig as a social worker. And this tiger shoe seemed to have more upside than Adidas. I wrote him back and offered him a post as a commissioned salesman, meaning I'd give him $1.75 for each pair of running shoes he sold, $2 for each pair of spikes. I was just beginning to form a crew of part-time sales reps, and that was the standard rate I was offering. He wrote back right away, accepting the offer. And then the letters didn't stop. On the contrary, they increased, in length and in number. At first they were 2 pages, then 4, then 8. At first they came every few days, then they came faster and faster, tumbling almost daily through the mail slot like a waterfall, each one with that same return address, P.O. Box 492, Seal Beach, California, 90740. Until I wondered what in God's name I'd done in hiring this guy. I liked his energy, of course, and it was hard to fault his enthusiasm, but I began to worry that he might have too much of each. With the 20th letter, or the 25th, I began to worry that the man might be unhinged. I wondered why everything was so breathless. I wondered if he was ever going to run out of things he urgently needed to tell me or ask me. I wondered if he was ever going to run out of stamps. Every time a thought crossed Johnson's mind, seemingly, he wrote it down and stuck it into an envelope. He wrote to tell me how many tigers he'd sold that week. He wrote to tell me how many tigers he'd sold that day. He wrote to tell me who'd worn tigers at which high school meet and in what place they'd finished. He wrote to say that he wanted to expand his sales territory beyond California to include Arizona and possibly New Mexico. He wrote to suggest that we open a retail store in Los Angeles. He wrote to tell me that he was considering placing ads in running magazines, and what did I think? He wrote to inform me that he'd placed those ads in running magazines, and the response was good. He wrote to ask why I hadn't answered any of his previous letters. He wrote to plead for encouragement. He wrote to complain that I hadn't responded to his previous plea for encouragement. I'd always considered myself a conscientious correspondent. I'd sent countless letters and postcards home during my trip around the world. I'd written faithfully to Sarah, and I always meant to answer Johnson's letters, but before I got around to it, there was always another one waiting. Something about the sheer volume of his correspondence stopped me. Something about his neediness, his urgency, made me not want to encourage him. Many nights I'd sit down at the Black Royal typewriter in my basement workshop, curl a piece of paper into the roller, and type, "Dear Jeff." Then I'd draw a blank. I wouldn't know where to begin, which of his 50 questions to start with, so I'd get up, attend to other things, and the next day there'd be yet another letter from Johnson, or two. Soon I'd be 3 letters behind, suffering from crippling writer's block. I asked Jean to deal with the Johnson file. "Fine," she said. Within a month, she thrust the file at me, exasperated. "You're not paying me enough," she said. At some point, I stopped reading Johnson's letters all the way to the bottom. But from skimming them, I learned he was selling tigers part-time and on weekends, that he decided to keep his day job as a social worker for Los Angeles County. I still couldn't fathom it. Johnson just didn't strike me as a people person. In fact, he'd always seemed somewhat misanthropic. It was one of the things I'd liked about him. In April 1965, he wrote to say he'd quit his day job. He'd always hated it, he said, but the last straw had been a distressed woman in the San Fernando Valley. He'd been scheduled to check on her because she threatened to kill herself, but he'd phoned her first to ask if she really was going to kill herself that day. If so, he didn't want to waste the time and gas money driving all the way out to the valley. The woman and Johnson's superiors took a dim view of his approach. They deemed it a sign that Johnson didn't care. Johnson deemed it the same way. He didn't care. And in that moment, Johnson wrote me, he understood himself and his destiny. Social work wasn't it. He wasn't put here on this earth to fix people's problems. He preferred to focus on their feet. In his heart of hearts, Johnson believed that runners are God's chosen, that running, done right, in the correct spirit and with the proper form, is a mystical exercise, no less than meditation or prayer. And thus he felt called to help runners reach their nirvana. I'd been around runners much of my life, but this kind of dewy romanticism was something I'd never encountered. Not even the Yahweh of running, Bowerman, was as pious about the sport as Blue Ribbon's part-time employee number two. In fact, in 1965, running wasn't even a sport. It wasn't popular, it wasn't unpopular, it just was. To go out for a 3-mile run was something weirdos did, presumably to burn off manic energy. Running for pleasure, running for exercise, running for endorphins, running to live better and longer, these things were unheard of. People often went out of their way to mock runners. Drivers would slow down and honk their horns. "Get a horse," they'd yell, throwing a beer or soda at the runner's head. Johnson had been drenched by many a Pepsi. He wanted to change all this. He wanted to help all the oppressed runners of the world, to bring them into the light and fold them in a community. So maybe he was a social worker after all. He just wanted to socialize exclusively with runners. Above all, Johnson wanted to make a living doing it, which was next to impossible in 1965. In me, in Blue Ribbon, he thought he saw a way. I did everything I could to discourage Johnson from thinking like this. At every turn, I tried to dampen his enthusiasm for me and my company. Besides not writing back, I never phoned, never visited, never invited him to Oregon. I also never missed an opportunity to tell him the unvarnished truth. In one of my rare replies to his letters, I put it flatly. "Though our growth has been good, I owe First National Bank of Oregon $11,000. Cash flow is negative." He wrote back immediately, asking if he could work for me full-time. "I want to be able to make it on Tiger, and the opportunity would exist for me to do other things as well, running, school, not to mention being my own boss." I shook my head. I tell the man Blue Ribbon is sinking like the Titanic, and he responds by begging for a berth in first class. Oh, well, I thought, if we do go down, misery loves company. So in the late summer of 1965, I wrote and accepted Johnson's offer to become the first full-time employee of Blue Ribbon. We negotiated his salary via the mail. He was making $460 a month as a social worker, but he said he could live on $400. I agreed, reluctantly. It seemed exorbitant, but Johnson was so scattered, so flighty, and Blue Ribbon was so tenuous. One way or another, I figured it was temporary. As ever, the accountant in me saw the risk. The entrepreneur saw the possibility. So I split the difference and kept moving forward. And then I stopped thinking about Johnson altogether. I had bigger problems at the moment. My banker was upset with me. After posting $8,000 in sales in my first year, I was projecting $16,000 in my second year. And according to my banker, this was a very troubling trend. "A 100% increase in sales is troubling?" I asked. "Your rate of growth is too fast for your equity," he said. "How can such a small company grow too fast?" "It's the same principle regardless of size," he said. "Growth off your balance sheet is dangerous." "Life is growth," I said. "Business is growth. You grow or you die. That's not how we see it. You might as well tell a runner in a race that he's running too fast." "Apples and oranges." "Your head is full of apples and oranges," I wanted to say. Somehow, I restrained myself. It was textbook to me. Growing sales plus profitability plus unlimited upside equals quality company. In those days, however, commercial banks were different from investment banks. Their focus was cash balances. They wanted you to never, ever outgrow your cash balance. Again and again, I gently try to explain the shoe business to my banker. If I don't keep growing, I'd say, I won't be able to persuade Onitsuka that I'm the best man to distribute their shoes in the West. If I can't persuade Onitsuka that I'm the best, they'll find some other Marlboro man to take my place. And that doesn't even take into account the battle with the biggest monster out there, Adidas. My banker was unmoved. Unlike Athena, he did not admire my eyes of persuasion. Mr. Knight, he'd say again and again, you need to slow down. You don't have enough equity for this kind of growth. Equity. How I was beginning to loathe this word. My banker used it over and over until it became a tune I couldn't get out of my head. Equity. I heard it while brushing my teeth in the morning. Equity. I heard it while punching my pillow at night. Equity. I reached the point where I refused to even say it aloud. Because it wasn't a real word. It was bureaucratic jargon. A euphemism for cold hard cash, of which I had none. Purposely. Any dollar that wasn't nailed down, I was plowing directly back into the business. Was that so rash? To have cash balances sitting around doing nothing made no sense to me. Sure, it would have been the cautious, conservative, prudent thing, but the roadside was littered with cautious, conservative, prudent entrepreneurs. I wanted to keep my foot pressed hard on the gas pedal. Somehow, in meeting after meeting, I held my tongue. I kept my cool. Everything my banker said, I ultimately accepted. Then I'd do exactly as I pleased. I'd place another order with Onitsuka, double the size of the previous order, and show up at the bank all wide-eyed innocence, asking for a letter of credit to cover it. My banker would be shocked. You want how much? And I'd always pretended to be shocked that he was shocked. I thought you'd see the wisdom. I'd wheedle, grovel, negotiate, and eventually he'd approve my loan. After I'd sold out the shoes and repaid the borrowing in full, I'd do it all over again. Place a mega order with Onitsuka, double the size of the previous order, then go to the bank in my best suit, an angelic look on my face. My banker's name was Harry White. 50-ish, avuncular, with a voice like a handful of gravel in a blender. He didn't seem to want to be a banker, and he particularly didn't want to be my banker. He inherited me by default. My first banker had been Ken Curry. But when my father refused to be my guarantor, Curry phoned him straight away. Between us, Bill, if the kid's company goes under, you'll still back him, right? Hell no, my father said. So Curry decided he wanted no part of this father-son internecine war and turned me over to White. White was a vice president at First National, but this title was misleading. He didn't have much power. The bosses were always looking over his shoulder, second-guessing him, and the bossiest of bosses was a man named Bob Wallace. It was Wallace who made life difficult for White, and thereby for me. It was Wallace who fetishized equity and poo-pooed growth. Squarely built, with a thuggish face and Nixonian 5 o'clock shadow, Wallace was 10 years my senior, but somehow thought himself the bank's boy wonder. He was also determined to become the bank's next president, and he viewed all bad credit risks as the main roadblock between him and that goal. He didn't like giving credit to anyone for anything, but with my balance hovering always around zero, he saw me as a disaster waiting to happen. One slow season, one downturn in sales, I'd be out of business. The lobby of Wallace's bank would be filled with my unsold shoes, and the holy grail of bank president would slip from his grasp. Like Sarah atop Mount Fuji, Wallace saw me as a rebel, but he didn't think of this as a compliment, nor in the end, come to think of it, had she. Of course, Wallace didn't always say all this directly to me. It was often conveyed by his middleman, White. White believed in me, and in Blue Ribbon. But he'd tell me all the time, with a sad headshake, that Wallace made the decisions, Wallace signed the checks, and Wallace was no fan of Phil Knight. I thought it was fitting and telling and hopeful that White would use that word, fan. He was tall, lean, a former athlete who loved to talk sports. No wonder we saw eye to eye. Wallace, on the other hand, looked as if he'd never set foot on a ball field, unless maybe to repossess the equipment. What sweet satisfaction it would have been to tell Wallace where he could shove his equity, then storm out and take my business elsewhere. But in 1965, there was no elsewhere. First National Bank was the only game in town, and Wallace knew it. Oregon was smaller back then, and it had just two banks, First National and U.S. Bank. The latter had already turned me down. If I got thrown out of the former, I'd be done. These days, you can live in one state and bank in another, no problem, but banking regulations were much tighter then. Also, there was no such thing as venture capital. An aspiring young entrepreneur had very few places to turn, and those places were all guarded by risk-averse gatekeepers with zero imagination. In other words, bankers. Wallace was the rule, not the exception. To make everything a little more difficult, Onitsuka was always late shipping my shoes, which gave me less time to sell, which meant less time to make enough money to cover my loan. When I complained, Onitsuka didn't answer. When they did answer, they failed to appreciate my quandary. Time and again, I'd send them a frantic telex inquiring about the whereabouts of the latest shipment. And in response, I'd typically get a telex that was maddeningly obtuse. Little more days. It was like dialing 911 and hearing someone on the other end yawn. Given all these problems, given Blue Ribbon's cloudy future, I decided that I'd better get a real job. Something safe to fall back on when everything went bust. At the same moment Johnson devoted himself exclusively to Blue Ribbon, I decided to branch out. By now I'd passed all parts of the CPA exam. So I mailed my test results and resume to several local firms, interviewed with three or four, and got hired by Price Waterhouse. Like it or not, I was officially and irrevocably a card-carrying bean counter. My tax returns for that year wouldn't list my occupation as self-employed or business owner or entrepreneur. They would identify me as Philip H. Knight, accountant. Most days, I didn't mind. For starters, I invested a healthy portion of my paycheck into Blue Ribbon's account at the bank, padding my precious equity, boasting the company's cash balance. Also, unlike Librand, the Portland branch of Price Waterhouse was a mid-sized firm. It had some 30 accountants on staff compared to Librand's 4, which made it a better fit for me.
The work suited me better, too. Price Waterhouse boasted a great variety of clients, a mix of interesting startups and established companies, all selling everything imaginable, lumber, water, power, food. While auditing these companies, digging into their guts, taking them apart and putting them back together, I was also learning how they survived, or didn't. How they sold things, or didn't. How they got into trouble, how they got out. I took careful notes about what made companies tick, what made them fail. Again and again, I learned that lack of equity was a leading cause of failure. The accountants worked in teams, generally, and the A-team was headed by Delbert J. Hayes, the best accountant in the office, and by far its most flamboyant character. 6'2", 300 pounds, most of it stuffed sausage-like into an exceedingly inexpensive polyester suit, Hayes possessed great talent, great wit, great passion, and great appetites. Nothing gave him more pleasure than laying waste to a hoagie and a bottle of vodka, unless it was doing both while studying a spreadsheet. And he had a comparable hunger for smoke. Rain or shine, he needed smoke running through his lungs and nasal passages. He chuffed through at least 2 packs a day. I'd met other accountants who knew numbers, who had a way with numbers, but Hayes was to the numbers born. In a column of otherwise unspectacular 4s and 9s and 2s, he could discern the raw elements of beauty. He looked at numbers the way the poet looks at clouds, the way the geologist looks at rocks. He could draw from them rhapsodic song, demotic truths. and uncanny predictions. Hayes could use numbers to tell the future. Day after day, I watched Hayes do something I'd never thought possible. He made accounting an art, which meant he and I and all of us were artists. It was a wonderful thought, an ennobling thought, one that would have never occurred to me. Intellectually, I always knew that numbers were beautiful. On some level, I understood that numbers represented a secret code, that behind every row of numbers lay clean, spare, platonic forms. My accounting classes had taught me that, sort of, as had sports. Running track gives you a fierce respect for numbers, because you are what your numbers say you are. Nothing more, nothing less. If I posted a bad time in a race, there might have been reasons. Injury, fatigue, nerves, broken heart. But no one cared. My numbers, in the end, were all that anyone would remember. I'd lived this reality, but Hayes the artist made me feel it. Alas, I came to fear that Hayes was the tragic sort of artist, the self-sabotaging Van Gogh kind. He undercut himself at the firm every day by dressing badly, slouching badly, behaving badly. He also had an array of phobias, heights, snakes, bugs, confined spaces, which could be off-putting to his bosses and colleagues. But he was the most phobic about diets. Pricewaterhouse would have made Hayes a partner without hesitation, despite all his many vices. But the firm couldn't overlook his weight. It wasn't going to tolerate a 300-pound partner. More than likely, it was this unhappy fact that made Hayes eat so much in the first place. Whatever the reason, he ate a lot. By 1965, he drank as much as he ate, which is saying a mouthful. And he refused to drink alone. Come quitting time, he'd insist that all his junior accountants join him. He talked like he drank, nonstop. Some of the other accountants called him Uncle Remus, but I never did. I never rolled my eyes at Hayes's stemwinders. Each story contained some gem of wisdom about business, what made companies work, what the ledgers of a company really meant. Thus, many nights, I'd voluntarily, even eagerly, enter some Portland dive and match Hayes round for round, shot for shot. In the morning, I'd wake feeling sicker than I had in that hammock in Calcutta, and it would take all my self-discipline to be of any use to Price Waterhouse. It didn't help that, when I wasn't a foot soldier in Hayes's army, I was still serving in the reserves, a 7-year commitment. Tuesday nights from 7 to 10, I had to throw a switch in my brain and become First Lieutenant Knight. My unit was composed of longshoremen, and we were often stationed in the warehouse district, a few football fields away from where I picked up my shipments from Onitsuka. Most nights my men and I would load and unload ships, maintain jeeps and trucks, and many nights we'd do PT, physical training, push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, running. I remember one night I led my company on a 4-mile run. I needed to sweat out the booze from a Hayes binge, so I set a killing pace and steadily increased it, grinding myself and the men to dust. After, I overheard one panting soldier tell another, "I was listening real close as Lieutenant Knight counted cadence. I never once heard that man take a deep breath." It was perhaps my only triumph of 1965. Some Tuesday nights in the reserves were set aside for classroom time. Instructors would talk to us about military strategy, which I found riveting. The instructors would often begin class by dissecting some long-ago famous battle, but invariably they would drift off-topic onto Vietnam. The conflict was getting hotter. The United States was being drawn toward it, inexorably, as if by a giant magnet. One instructor told us to get our personal lives in order, kiss our wives and girlfriends goodbye. We were going to be in the shit real soon. I had grown to hate that war. Not simply because I felt it was wrong, I also felt it was stupid, wasteful. I hated stupidity. I hated waste. Above all, that war, more than other wars, seemed to be run along the same principles as my bank. Fight not to win, but to avoid losing. A surefire losing strategy. My fellow soldiers felt the same way. Is it any wonder that, the moment we were dismissed, we marched double time to the nearest bar? Between the reserves and Hayes, I wasn't sure my liver was going to see 1966. Now and then Hayes would hit the road, visit clients across Oregon, and I frequently found myself part of his traveling medicine show. Of all his junior accountants, I might have been his favorite, but especially when he traveled. I liked Hayes a lot, but I was alarmed to discover that when on the road, he really let his hair down. And as always, he expected his cohorts to do the same. It was never enough to just drink with Hayes. He demanded that you match him, drop for drop. He counted drinks as carefully as he counted credits and debits. He said often that he believed in teamwork, and if you were on his team, by God, you'd better finish that damn drink. Half a century later, my stomach rolls when I recall touring with Hayes around Albany, Oregon, doing a job for Watchung Exotic Metals. Each night, after crunching the numbers, we'd hit a little dive on the edge of town and close it down. I also recall, dimly, blurred days in Walla Walla doing a job for Birdseye, followed by nightcaps at the City Club. Walla Walla was a dry town, but bars got around the law by calling themselves clubs. Membership in the City Club was $1, and Hayes was a member in good standing. Until I misbehaved and got us kicked out. I don't remember what I did, but I'm sure it was awful. I'm equally sure I couldn't help myself. By then my blood was 50% gin. I vaguely remember throwing up all over Hayes's car. I vaguely remember him very sweetly and patiently telling me to clean it up. What I remember vividly is that Hayes grew red in the face, righteously indignant on my behalf, even though I was clearly in the wrong and resigned his membership in the City Club. Such loyalty, such unreasonable and unwarranted fealty, that might have been the moment I fell in love with Hayes. I looked up to the man when he saw something deeper in numbers, but I loved him when he saw something special in me. On one of those road trips, in one of our boozy late-night conversations, I told Hayes about Blue Ribbon. He saw promise in it. He also saw doom. The numbers, he said, didn't lie. Starting a new company, he said, in this economy, and a shoe company to boot, with zero cash balance? He slouched and shook his big fuzzy head. On the other hand, he said, I had one thing in my favor. Bowerman. A legend for a partner. That was one asset for which it was impossible to assign a number. Plus, my asset was rising in value. Bowerman had gone to Japan for the 1964 Olympics to support the members of the U.S. track and field team he'd coached. Two of his runners, Bill Dellinger and Harry Jerome, medaled. And after the games, Bowerman had switched hats and become an ambassador for Blue Ribbon. He and Mrs. Bowerman, whose Christmas Club account had provided the initial $500 Bowerman gave me to form our partnership, took a train south to Kobe and visited Onitsuka and charmed everyone in the building. They were given a royal welcome, a VIP tour of the factory, and Morimoto even introduced them to Mr. Onitsuka. The two old lions, of course, bonded. Both, after all, were built from the same last, shaped by the same war. Both still approached everyday life as a battle. Mr. Onitsuka, however, had the particular tenacity of the defeated, which impressed Bowerman. Mr. Onitsuka told Bowerman about founding his shoe company in the ruins of Japan, when all the big cities were still smoldering from American bombs. He'd built his first lasts for a line of basketball shoes by pouring hot wax from Buddhist candles over his own feet. Though the basketball shoes didn't sell, Mr. Onitsuka didn't give up. He simply switched to running shoes, and the rest was shoe history. Every Japanese runner in the 1964 games, Bowerman told me, was wearing Tigers. Mr. Onitsuka also told Bowerman that the inspiration for the unique soles on Tigers had come to him while eating sushi. Looking down at his wooden platter at the underside of an octopus's leg, he thought a similar suction cup might work on the sole of a runner's flat. Bowerman filed that away. Inspiration, he learned, can come from quotidian things. Things you might find lying around the house. Now back in Oregon, Bowerman was